In 1995, Comet 73P did something very unexpected. It fell apart for no apparent reason. The comet's nucleus split into at least three mini comets flying single file through space. Astronomers watched with interest, but the view was blurry even through large telescopes. A 73P was 150 million miles away. And we're about to get a much closer look in May of this year. The fragments are going to fly past Earth closer than any comet has come in more than 20 years. Now, they say there is no danger of a collision. The closest fragment will be about 6 million miles away, 25 times farther than the moon. But that's close. But they don't think it's very scary. And Europe's Venus Express probe has returned its first images since slipping into the orbit around our nearest planetary neighbor. You can see these pictures on coasttocoastam.com. Mission scientists are already intrigued by a dark vortex feature, which can be clearly seen in one image. The Venus Express will orbit the planet for about 500 Earth days to study its atmosphere, which is thought to have undergone runaway greenhouse warming. In a moment, we're going to run with William Henry. He's back from Egypt. He's going to tie it into Atlantis. All that on Coast to Coast AM. Well, he's an investigative mythologist. He is an author. His name is William Henry. He's a regular guest on Coast to Coast. He's been to Egypt. He's got a new DVD set called Egypt, The Shadow of Atlantis. And he links the Atlantis myth with Egypt. Some incredible pictures on the coasttocoastam.com website, by the way, that William and his group have supplied to us. Welcome, William Henry. Hello, William. How are you?
Hey, George. How are you? Great to talk with you.
You know, if we played sound effects, we would have a huge audience in the background applauding every time you would come on.
Oh, and that would be Jimmy Page over there in the corner playing guitar, too.
Absolutely. So I trust you had a safe trip to Egypt and back.
I did. Thank you. Safe and truly, truly wonderful. Absolutely transformative and just so excited to come back and report some of this new information, some really groundbreaking stuff that is just magic.
How long were you out there?
2 weeks.
Are you at all skittish when you're out there? I mean, there's been so much happening in the Middle East. I mean, sometimes I would think, my gosh, if I'm going to sit here in this cafe, is some lunatic going to walk in and blow himself up? I mean, do you think about things like that? Are you more aware of your surroundings?
Well, just a little bit. You're in a foreign country. You're in a land that is predominantly Muslim, and you just never know these days what may be coming around the next bend. But Egypt is such a place of just tremendous open-heartedness, and the people are amazingly friendly. They love Americans, and they have this viewpoint that is just unparalleled anywhere. The one thing I did notice that was different about my last trip, though, is that it seems that some of the market people were a little too aggressive. It's like they must be suffering a little bit economically somehow. But other than that, there was not a single moment where I could say I felt any kind of fear or any danger whatsoever.
Now, when you say aggressive, the market people are aggressive. Give me a for instance. You'd be what, like walking through the market? What would happen?
Well, yeah, I was one day I was walking with two of our guests, women, and one stayed behind to take a look at an item. And before she knew it, she had hands all over her, and they're begging her for money. And that's kind of the treatment. And of course, it was tremendously unnerving for her and felt just awful about what had happened. But it's just kind of the sign of the times there, I think.
Well, and if you give them money, it becomes a feeding frenzy, doesn't it?
It really does. They literally come out of nowhere. And one of the most difficult things to handle on an emotional level is when it's the children that are coming up asking for things. I mean, you have to just understand that this is the way of life that they're brought up in, and you hope that things are beginning to transform there, where they're going to have opportunities to expand their lives that aren't there presently. So it's heartbreaking in many, many times, but you have to just move through it and accept it.
I looked at some of the pictures of Egypt that you had emailed me, William, a few days ago, and I got to tell you, it looks in some cases as if that area has stayed the same for 2,000 years.
Yeah. When you go to some of these remote villages, George, you are stepping back in time and experiencing Egypt little changed for several to 5,000 years. The only difference that is, and it's so strange, is that you'll be out in a remote village. Let's say you're on a bus and you're driving to Abydos, one of my favorite places, and it's very rural, very country, out in the middle of nowhere. You see these mud brick homes sitting beside the canal with satellite dishes on top of them.
That's funny.
Yeah.
You wonder if they even have electricity, but they've got those satellite dishes.
Right, exactly. I mean, it's like they skipped the past 2,000 years and are just going right into the 21st century and watching Wheel of Fortune or something. It's bizarre.
That is something. What was the purpose of going to Egypt this time?
Well, I had lots of follow-up research that I wanted to do. I also had along with me the National Geographic Channel.
Oh, really?
Yes. This was a surprise. Came up about a month before the trip. They had gotten in touch with a gentleman who was one of our guests on the trip, and they learned about some of the research that I was doing. They're doing a program on Atlantis, and they have grown somewhat weary of the typical Edgar Cayce Atlantis rising story.
Right.
And Atlantis is Thera, and the volcano at Thera, the whole
world.
Well,
you know, that's all great stuff, William, but it's been said a million times.
Exactly. And so they kind of looked at me and said, well, this guy's got a little bit of a breath of fresh air. He's got a different take on it, a different perspective. And I had no idea before we left that they were going to spend as much time with me as they did. Literally 5-6 days, I had a camera in my face virtually at all times, everywhere I went. And unfortunately, everywhere the group went, too, the National Geographic channels were on us, and they tried to be as unobtrusive as possible, but some people got a little bit irritated about it. I apologize for that. But overall, they were trying to really document an Egyptian experience, especially an Egyptian experience coming from someone who's there to investigate these mysteries.
All right, beyond Abydos, so what locations did you go to?
Well, we hit them all. We hit all the major sites, the Great Pyramid, of course, the Sphinx, learned a tremendous amount of new information there from another of our guests, Mr. Freddie Silva. And then we went on down to, of course, Abydos, Dendera, Luxor, Abu Simbel, Philae, all the major sites. We hit them. I mean, it was quite an excursion.
What is it like, William, to be really close, maybe even at the base of the foot of the Sphinx and the pyramids of Giza?
To me, when you first stand there, I had no doubt whatsoever that I was looking at a monument that was the product of an advanced civilization that probably even exceeds our capabilities today. It is the most awe-inspiring experience you can ever imagine in your life. Any photograph you ever see of the Great Pyramid only serves to diminish the personal experience that you have on that plateau.
Of course, you can't tell Zahi Hawass that you think it had some kind of extraterrestrial intervention. He'll go crazy.
Oh, totally nuts. And in fact, that is the tightrope that I sort of have to walk. It's this idea that before the first Egyptian dynasty around 3100 BC, that there was an advanced race that inhabited this area, whether or not they came from outside of Egypt or inside of Egypt. Today, you can't talk about that, and the reason is because of what the Nazis did with this master race theory, this super race theory. Before 1932, it was fairly widely accepted among Egyptologists that there was, at one time, this advanced race in Egypt. After Hitler, if you even consider that or contemplate that idea, it's not only politically incorrect, they label you a racist because they say, oh, now you're denying Egyptian heritage. That's not true at all. What we're trying to do is dig for the truth here. And unfortunately, politics and to a large extent religion have intervened once again to put the blinders on us. And it's a very, very frustrating experience.
Yeah, that is a shame. Was he around wherever you were, or did he not show up? Hawass.
Like a hawk. Everywhere we went, especially with National Geographic.
Oh, I mean, he loves those cameras.
Right. I mean, those two words, National Geographic, opened doors that are normally closed. But even they, to be quite honest with you, have to sort of tiptoe around on eggshells around him because you just never know how he's going to respond. And wait till he gets a hold of this program. He's going to have a, you know, his coffee, I'm sure, is going to be all over his television screen when he sees what I have to say.
He's got a lot of energy, but as you have just pointed out, and as we have witnessed just by seeing him in the past on some of these live events when they try to go down the shafts of some of the pyramids, he is a booster for Egypt and will not back down on it, to the point where I got to believe the guy, William, has a pretty big temper.
Yes. Yeah, I would concur with that. And that's why I just prefer, hey, you know, I would love to meet him sometime. I mean, just out of respect, because he is the in charge of the Antiquities Council in Egypt. I mean, but at the same time, I am wise enough to know, hey, I got to aim high, pick my shots, and be passionate. And if he doesn't want to accept my shots, hey, that's okay. He's going to try and block them, or he's going to refute them, and that's just the way it is. But so long as he plays fair, and that's my only real concern in a lot of these areas, especially with academics and some researchers, they do not play fair. And it's largely to satisfy their own ego, I believe, but ultimately it's all of us that lose when people put their personal beliefs in front of what we think is a search for the truth.
You know, William, you know, you've been with me now for years. This is the most riled up I've ever heard you. Did he try to pull a fast one out there?
No, not at all. I guess you're just kind of pushing the right button tonight, George.
Okay. Well, I'm glad you're back safe and sound.
Oh, me too. Believe me. The whole time I'm in Egypt, George, I'm thinking, well, okay, April 13th, I'm going to be home. I'm going to be talking with George. Everything's going to be okay. So thanks for being kind of a beacon for me and a little light at the end of the tunnel for me.
Oh, that's okay. Well, you were out there during the total solar eclipse, weren't you?
Mm-hmm.
Tell me about that. And how do people react? Because I have heard that in some countries that some people are panicked stricken over an eclipse.
Well, sure. I mean, it's one of the single most powerful experiences that you can have. We had actually planned to go into what is called the Path of Totality, which was running along the border between Egypt and Libya. Originally, the estimate was going to be they were anticipating around 5,000 people to descend on this tiny village of Saloum. By the time all of the eclipse tour people got involved, there were nearly 50,000 people descending on this tiny dot of real estate that was equipped for more like 500. And so what we decided to do is to go to a closed archaeological site, which we're going to talk about in detail tonight, I hope, called Abu Ghraib, which is about 15 minutes as the heron flies from the Great Pyramid. And we experienced the total eclipse of the sun there. And that was absolutely the best choice. We were all alone and had just a truly wonderful afternoon.
Well, you know, as you go out to Egypt to look at the pyramid, the Sphinx, and the other incredible structures that are out there, what happens to you as a human being, William, when you see this? I've never had the luxury of being in Egypt. I mean, does your psyche change? Do you start to think about, you know, that this universe is different? What happens to you?
That's a phenomenal question, George, because that is exactly what happens. When you are there, you are, one, stepping back in time and experiencing temples in an experience that is thousands of years old. You're stepping into a vast movie set, if you will, and the name of the movie is Transform This Ordinary Mortal That Has Stepped On to This Great Land Called Egypt That Was Anciently Called Khem. Give us your heart. Give us your mind. We'll feed your soul. And that is what happens in Egypt. I made the mistake this time. It's no mistakes, but in my second presentation, I was talking about how important this concept of lightness of heart is to the ancient Egyptians. It was symbolized by a feather, and the idea was that at the time of death that your heart would be weighed against the feather, and if it was heavier, then they were going to press the recycle button on you, essentially. This experience for me was utterly transformative because I learned that I had a heavier heart than I really appreciated before in my life. Egypt took care of that through the people that were on the tour, the circumstances of the tour, being in Egypt itself. It, for me, this time was a cleansing and transformative experience that I know is setting my life into a new direction. And that is the potential that Egypt has for everybody that visits. And I hope, George, that I'll be able to go with you when you go your first time.
Well, I like the way you said that, when I go, because I do want to get out there one day. Do they have capabilities of doing broadcasts live out there, do you think?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. In fact, you can use your wireless computer system to make phone calls. They've got all kinds of any kind of modern technological implement that you would need is just a heartbeat away. So absolutely.
That would be an interesting broadcast with Zahi Hawass jumping in every once in a while if I said the wrong thing. Censoring me. You talked about Abydos. It fascinates me primarily because of that, I guess, that template, that etching that shows what looks like a helicopter and a submarine. You know that picture I'm talking about?
Oh, sure. Absolutely. Yeah. In fact, the temple guards there know all about it, too, the temple keepers, and they'll take you there for a small fee. It's one of the primary attractions there.
What do they say about that?
Well, they kind of go along with it. Some people have tried to refute that, saying that the glyph is actually caused by two overlapping hieroglyphs. But hey, I look at it, and it sure looks like a tank and a helicopter to me. And when you factor in the strangeness that surrounds Abydos and its location beside this temple called the Osirian, which many believe is actually at least 10,000 years old, it suggests to me that this could well be a representation of a technology that existed long, long ago that was immortalized on the walls at Abydos.
Do other Egyptians kind of share that too, or do they believe whatever Zahi Hawass is talking about?
Well, quietly. I mean, at first, your guides basically tell you the party line. And after about the first 30 seconds of that, the whole group is saying, well, now tell us what you really think.
Yeah.
And they start to open up just a little bit and share some of their own personal convictions. And that's when you really start to learn. I mean, as you can imagine, the folks that travel with me are not your average tourists. They know when someone is feeding them a line, and they're quite capable of refuting the talk or refuting the facts that the person is giving them and asking the penetrating questions that will reveal the actual truth of a situation. And so, I mean, that's what happened with the guide that we had on our tour, is that he finally gave up and started offering his own personal views based upon his research and started to even question some of the other things that he has been taught by traditional Egyptology.
And I bet he had a better time, too, didn't he?
Well, absolutely. I mean, we were quite a handful, but still, I think he's going to go back and look at these monuments the next time with a little bit clearer vision.
William, whenever you travel, you have a mission. I mean, you've been to Rennes Le Chateau, and you've been to different areas around this planet, but you go out there with a focus, with a specific reason. Did you on this particular trip?
Well, I did. I was wanting to go to Abu Ghraib, especially this incredibly magical place that I had never been before, and investigate the possibility that it was an ancient stargate. That's what indigenous Egyptian tradition says, is that this was a place of connection where the divine beings called Neter may have, in the ancient past, quote-unquote, landed.
Let's talk about that when we come back, William. What a great staff. We're talking about Egypt with William Henry, and they've got the right bumper music already picked out. They're quick. Hey, if you're a fan of Dr. Doom, Ed Dames, or Glynis McCants, the numbers lady, Be sure to get your hands on the May issue of the After Dark newsletter. You'll also get 14 issues for the price of 12. Ed decides he's not going to hold back anymore, and he'll tell us what he really thinks of Luciferian Aaron Donahue and that issue. So make sure you read this one. Subscribe now by calling 1-888-727-5505. 1-888-727-5505. Operators are there now, or subscribe online at coasttocoastam.com. And welcome back. I'm George Norrie, William Henry. William, let's talk about this Stargate mission you're on.
Great. Yeah, this place I went to, I investigated, is called Abu Ghraib. It's the same name as that despicable Iraqi prison.
Oh, my God, yeah. You weren't there, were you?
No. But it's a place in Egypt, again, about 12, 15 miles from the Great Pyramid. In fact, when you're standing on the pyramid at Abu Ghraib, you can actually see the Great Pyramid Complex as well as Saqqara and the other areas. You're literally in what's called a pyramid field, which is what it sounds like, a field of pyramids that are ancient, ancient, ancient.
They look crumbling in the pictures you sent me. They're falling apart.
Exactly. In fact, this is it's with a little bit of concern about that I actually decided to talk about Abu Ghraib. I consulted with Stephen Mailer, author of The Land of Osiris, about this when I got home, who has also spoken about Abu Ghraib, and said, Stephen, gosh, you know, I've got some tremendous new information about Abu Ghraib, but personally, I'm not sure I really want to call it that much attention to the place because it's so fragile. It's a closed to the public archaeological site. It's questionable about whether or not we actually broke the law going there. And it's not set up for spiritual warriors to all of a sudden start making a beeline for the place. But I decided that I think that this information is just too important to keep to myself, and have decided, okay, well, we've really got to talk about this place because it has so many ramifications in so many different areas concerning the study of the ancients, possibly concerning the Anunnaki, and also this idea of stargates.
Okay, so you go on out there, you're looking for this ancient stargate, and give me your definition of this stargate.
Well, the Stargate is both either a portal, a literal door or gate leading to the stars, or it's a location where star beings come through in the form of energies that the ancient Egyptians knew as netters, N-E-T-E-R-S. That's where we get our word nature. And according to Abdel Al-Kilkim, who is Stephen Mailer's teacher and others, this site was designed specifically to create heightened spiritual awareness through vibrations that were transmitted through this massive, massive alabaster crystal platform sitting in front of this pyramid there. In fact, ancient Egyptian legend, or Kemeshian legend to be more specific, says that these netters, these divine energies, or even divine beings actually landed at Abu Ghraib. And this is why it's considered to be not only the most ancient or oldest ceremonial center on the planet, but one of the most sacred places on the planet as well.
See, I don't know if the Giza pyramids are 5,000, 10,000, or even older years old. These looked pretty old. I mean, they looked like they were ready to fall apart.
Yeah, they do. And in fact, there's hallmarks that identify the age of this site and link it to others. And the primary hallmark is the use of these precision cut, polished, and placed red granite casing stones that you see on the front of the pyramid. And in fact, I believe I've got a plate that's on the Coast to Coast site that shows this red granite in front of this pyramid. Yeah, I believe it's plate number 3.
All right.
When we look at this, we're seeing these massive granite blocks that are, as I say, precision cut, polished, and placed with extraordinary accuracy by some group of beings that had some method of maneuvering and placing these stones that does not seem to be attributable to any normal means that we would see.
It was a guy with a chisel, William.
Yeah, right. I mean, take a copper chisel and see what a copper chisel looks like after a confrontation with a big slab of red granite like this.
What about the theory that the blocks were poured blocks in the spots that they are? So they built, you know, the frame, and then they poured, I would guess, what, liquid limestone or something, and it hardened?
Well, I think that that's a very interesting theory. I haven't personally seen enough evidence to say that that's the way they did it. Anti-gravity has also been suggested. One of my all-time goals now, I interviewed Stephen Mailer on Dreamland last year, and before I did so, it was kind of cool because a woman emailed me saying, well, you know, you two guys kind of disagree on some things, but I think that between the two of you, you are going to come up with irrefutable proof of ancient Egyptian anti-gravity. And ever since I've received that email, that's become sort of my life's quest. And I'm looking forward to furthering my connection with Stephen and Hakeem, his teacher, and others that are attempting to recover this ancient secret of anti-gravity. So anybody who has any insight into that, please let me know.
Well, he's dead, unfortunately. Edward Leeds Scullin, the
You're
guy
right.
who built the Coral Castle.
You're right.
Same
Absolutely
technology.
Right.
And I believe he was once quoted as saying he possessed the technology of the Egyptians.
Well, it's there. And the thing that drives me, George, is that we hear about this ancient indigenous oral tradition that exists in Egypt. And the way I came to understand that on this recent trip is that the stones there speak, the temples speak, the gods and goddesses speak to you. If you have the right energy, the right frequency, the open heart, the open mind, you can literally, quote unquote, be gifted with this knowledge. Some people today refer to it as a download. And I literally believe that this knowledge is in the vibrations of the stones in the temples themselves, and it's there for us to access if we approach this place with the right, quote-unquote, attitude.
Now, when you go and you're searching for information on a Stargate, are you looking for the Stargate specifically?
Well, I'm looking for depictions that portray gods aboard craft that resemble precisely the way modern science portrays wormholes.
All right.
For one thing, I'm looking for evidence of ancient particle accelerators, devices that are used to drill holes in space. And I have found evidence of that at Abydos. And I have found numerous examples over and over again portraying the gods sailing aboard their craft that resemble wormholes into gates that are composed of stars. I call those gates composed of stars stargates.
And the craft, based on what we have seen, people have witnessed, the oval shapes and cigar shapes, things like that?
No, actually, the craft that they're riding in look like the classic depiction of a wormhole, which has an open mouth on one end, it has a throat, and an open mouth on the other end. In fact, one of the plates that I supplied, plate number one, portrays one of these immortal beings with a light heart sailing into a net or a field that is called the Field of the Blessed. Ancient Egyptian myth, legend, and references suggest that this Field of the Blessed that this figure is sailing into is another dimension.
That is fascinating, William. I mean, can you imagine stumbling into this?
Well, I know. And so that's why I was so tremendously excited, because here is some references to this specific place, Abu Ghraib, as having been constructed long ago as one of these, what I call, stargates. And so here it is, and it's near what is today fragile, but still quite undisturbed state. I mean, this place looks the way it might have thousands and thousands of years ago. Now, what we need to add into this, too, as we continue our conversation, is that while there, we discovered that this site might even match what Zachariah Sitchin describes as one of the Anunnaki gold mining, gold processing sites, adds a whole nother dimension to this site as well.
Can you imagine if you were able to prove that? Oh, would you blow this wide open?
Well, that's what I'm thinking. And now, I have to offer this caveat again. Most of what I knew about Abu Ghraib going in came from Stephen Mailer and his teacher, Hakim. Now, neither Hakim nor Stephen Mailer support Sitchin's ideas of a metal-producing plant at Abu Ghraib, nor do they like the idea of Atlantis either. Hakim is adamant that ancient Kemet was not a colony of Atlantis and had an advanced civilization well over 10,000 years ago. Still, when we put the evidence on the table, and I'm having this, the article that I wrote that's posted on my site called Place of the Gods sent to Sitchin right now for him to take a look at, if he will. And I'm really hoping to open up this conversation. In fact, I'll be in Kempton, Illinois on May 5th and 6th conferring with Chris Dunn and David Hatcher Childress about this as well. So really trying to get a dialogue going on this possibility here.
Chris Dunn believing that the pyramids of Giza are power plants.
Absolutely. Without a doubt. Imagine you could shrink yourself down to the size of a pea and crawl inside a modern Corvette engine. That's the feeling that you get when you go inside the Great Pyramid. You're inside a vast, powerful, smoking engine that is utterly, utterly, unimaginably powerful.
These stargates that we're talking about that open up these portals either throughout the universe or who knows where, maybe other dimensions. Did anybody ever mention the possibility that demons could come through them?
Well, absolutely. I mean, in fact, I am tracking these beings that I know you've talked about recently called Archons.
Yes.
I've been writing about them since 2002, 2003, beginning an Oracle of the Illuminati, identifying these Archon beings that were written about and talked about by the Gnostics and the earliest Christians. They are equated with the gray aliens. They are known as the Watchers. I believe that one of the tasks that they have assigned to themselves is they are guardians of these portals. As I wrote in my book, The Illuminator, about Mary Magdalene, she was given specific knowledge by Jesus after the resurrection concerning the language of the Archons and how to evade the Archons in the soul's quest to return to the source.
William, in the work that you were doing when you went there and you started to tie it into the solar eclipse, did you also look into our own moon and its ramifications on the planet?
I did. I had to. It's something that I hadn't paid a great deal of attention to before, but here I am preparing to go experience a total solar eclipse of the sun, which meant that I had to learn a little bit something about our planet's interaction with the moon. And I learned that there's this amazing debate going on about what exactly is the moon. Is the moon, in fact, an artificial satellite? Because science says that the likelihood that an Earth-like planet like ours should have such a large moon is incredibly, incredibly small. And so we have to begin to look for some kind of an accounting of how this came to be.
Well, I think maybe it was formed when an object smashed into the planet. What do you think?
Well, that's certainly one of the hypotheses, that the moon was formed independently from the same cloud of dust and gas as the Earth, or that it was once part of the Earth, or perhaps even part of a former planet called Tiamat that existed in our solar system.
What is your belief system?
I believe that the moon is an artificial Earth satellite that was put into orbit by advanced beings who had a technology exactly like we're beginning to imagine today with our nanotechnology and our advanced physics, but which we are not quite capable of duplicating yet.
That's a John Lear theory as well. He believes the moon was towed into its present orbit.
Well, I think that's a pretty reasonable speculation. I'll also go along with John Lear's notion concerning the possible purpose of the moon. Other than to regulate the tides on Earth and to enable land masses to be formed on this planet and therefore life to evolve on land, the ancients clearly believed that the moon was a gate for souls. They viewed the moon as the home of the dead, as a female gate through which souls passed on the way to the paradise field of the stars.
Isn't it interesting that the Giza pyramids are all tied into that too?
Well, yeah, I mean, and that you have to just be blown away by that. In fact, what I came to was the notion that the Earth-Moon system is, in fact, a vast temple for our soul's growth. The Great Pyramid is the spiritual hub of this planet. It's located at the exact geographical center of the land masses of the Earth. And it's believed to be part of a worldwide pyramid system created in prehistory that's mounted like an antenna on key energy meridians on our planet, which were employed by the ancient pre-scientists as a musical system to stabilize the tectonic plates of this planet, assisting in allowing life to evolve on land. And this brings up an interesting pun. Ancient Egypt was called Mer or Mera, which meant beloved land.
The possibilities that the moon was towed into its orbit by extraterrestrials, I would assume. What was the? I mean, did they know that we needed a moon for other purposes, or do you think it's like the starship in Star Wars, the
Death Star,
the Death Star, exactly.
Yeah. I think it's actually both, George, because the moon and plate tectonics is what is unique about Earth. What is unique about the Earth is that it has liquid water, both fresh and seawater and land. And this is because if the moon had not carried away most of the crust from the Pacific basin, presumably, there would be no ocean basins, no land, and no chance for life to evolve on land. Earth would be a water world. You and I would not be having this conversation.
Well, if we did, we'd be talking with bubbles in our mouth. Huh?
Yeah, we'd be dolphin speak or whale speak.
The Dolphin Show with William Henry. Well, of everything that you investigated on this trip, was there one thing that just knocked you out?
Well, a lot of things, really, but primarily it gets back to Abu Ghraib and this idea that there was this ancient place of the gods and that it's still intact and it's there to be studied. Now, I, again, am tying this in with Atlantis, which was the secondary mission that I had on this trip, was to look at the ancient Egyptian beliefs concerning this island civilization created by formless beings that came from the stars and created civilization on Earth. That's the Atlantis story. And it's one that is not often discussed, but which I think is definitely worthy of consideration.
I think so, too, William. As a matter of fact, let's devote some time to it next hour.
Beautiful.
We'll get your tape on Atlantis and how it ties into Egypt. Very possible that those Atlanteans went to Egypt a long time ago.